My God, it's full of stars.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight, we're going to talk about the movie 2010, The Year We Make Contact.
But no Brother Drew. Womp womp.
Yes. He's had to go into inpatient therapy for his misophonia. Actually, that's not nice to say. And
no, I completely identify with most of what he says.
Oh no, me too, but not to the extent, of course. At least for me. But
oh, I am him. I just have never vocalized it.
Yeah. So see, what I thought that was bravery on his part.
No, absolutely. Because I'm usually just turn the TV up louder.
Yeah. It turns out we all have our little things.
Like, my new desk at work, I got my desk, finally. Whee! One of my coworkers who sits behind me, who's a very lovely lady, but I don't know what she's eating half the time when she's eating, because my back is to her. And I swear to God, it's like 5,000-year-old granola bars.
Listener Lindsay posted on Facebook today that if the waiting room is empty, you are not allowed to tap your foot the entire time you're waiting for an appointment.
I tend to tap my fingers, my nails especially, you know, that.
Yeah.
It drives people crazy. Yeah. And sometimes I'm not even aware I'm doing it, so sorry, everybody.
The problem is, I don't know what, I'm sure there is a diagnostic name, if not actually a diagnostic code for this, but upon finding out that it irritates somebody, to continue doing it on purpose because it makes you laugh to be an irritant, I have whatever that is.
Yes, it's called assholeism.
Yes, apparently. Well, I'm a recovering asshole, apparently. So, yeah. Oh, well, maybe not recovering too much. Maybe I'm not the first step is to admit you have a problem.
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't quite got through the 12 steps. You're working the steps.
Oh.
But unfortunately, they click and annoy somebody, so you just keep working them.
Yeah. So, anyway. So, yeah, Drew is being a full-time single parent at the moment.
Mr. Mom.
Yeah, family obligations cropped up, and so Drew's not with us, but he's not being suspended. He'll have a lot to say when he comes back, though. It'll be 2 weeks from now, because he is already going to be off next week. So, it's all very complicated.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So, what are we doing next week?
Next week, we're doing Roxanne, and we're going to keep with that schedule, because we have a listener in England who is going to drop us a piece of audio about her feelings about Roxanne.
Awesome.
So, yeah, so
it was, awesome.
Yeah.
Who knew we had such fervent listeners in the UK?
Yeah.
Shout out to the UK and the 24 flake bars I just bought from the UK.
Yes, see? We're devoted Anglophiles, if only for candy. Also, shout out to Rwanda, our latest country.
Not just for candy in the UK. I love the BBC.
Let's see. I like PG Tips tea, which I realize is not, you know, the best tea, but it certainly has a nice little pyramid thing. Although, what is it? Taifu is pretty good too. And let's see, what else? Yeah, all the candy. These days, I'm liking the idea of having a parliamentary system of government.
Well, just the sheer fact that they can select and decide a leader in like a day.
Yeah. Well, and all elections take like 60 days total or 6 weeks or something.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing and impressive. It makes you feel really inferior and long for a better system.
Well, not to say that their politics aren't a shit show as well.
Yes, but at least they sound better. And I guarantee they don't have one of their politicians talking about grabbing some woman by her vagina.
Yeah, you can't even say it, can you? I can't say it. And I hate the fact that now everybody can say it.
I can say it. I just don't want to say it because I don't want to quote him. So I refuse to say it.
Yeah, I was trying to, on the car on the way home, I was trying to see if I could Weird Al style rewrite the song Grease Lightning.
Oh, dear.
Having Donald Trump sing it. Because he can say something along the lines of, you know, I got that swagger, I'm a real pussy grabber. But I can't think of what the Grease Lightning would turn into. So
some of the tweets following that, some of the tweets are amazing. One woman was lamenting the fact, I think it was actually a Facebook post, she was lamenting the fact that she couldn't actually allow her daughter to watch the election because her daughter's in elementary school. And the assignment was that they had to spend a half an hour watching the debate. She said,
no,
I can't really let her watch it because the likelihood is I'm going to have to explain something to her that I am not willing to explain.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. No, that's, you know what? Yeah. I can't let my, my elementary school child watch the political presidential debate. That's what we come to.
Yeah. It kind of saddens me a bit.
So
anyway, not to delve too deeply into politics, because really this is about a movie that had a Cold War politics in it.
Absolutely, yeah. I was thinking, you know, I feel like sometimes that I am like a child of the Woodstock generation, even though I just got in, you know, the year of Woodstock.
You snuck in under the radar.
Yeah, and you are a child, we're like sort of Cold War baby.
Absolutely. Well, and we like talked about it before.
Nixon and stuff. You know. And then Drew, of course, is Drew's a Reagan baby.
And, you know, I'm enough of a Nixon. I mean, obviously, I was... You know, Nixon was before me, but it was happening around me and I was too young to know. But, you know, I'm a huge, like, you know, as we've discussed, All the President's Men. Great movie. Bad politics.
I'm not saying you're pro-Nixon. I'm just saying, like, you're a lot. I mean, you've said before, your life is, your childhood was informed a lot by Cold War and mutually assured destruction.
Yeah, in ways that still affect me. I mean, smaller ways as I get older and I get more, you know, other things scare me now, like presidential elections. Like
presidential politics. Remember those quaint days when we thought, well, I'm not going to vote for John McCain. He's certainly qualified, but I don't really believe in his, you know, his policies and stuff and whatever. But now it's like, oh no, one person is qualified and another person is a crazy person, megalomaniac, Batman villain.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you long for the days of Mitt Romney.
Yes, yes.
When he was the reasonable candidate.
Absolutely.
Because at least we had some debate, you know, we had some substantial debate. And I think during those years, when we had that discourse, it elevated us. When you have a debate of peers that exchange ideas and thoughts and cause deep thinking that elevates us all. But the last debate cannot have done any of that. It wasn't even good television. It was the West Wing coming to life almost.
It made me so tense the whole time. It was just the worst. Although I liked the last question because at least it released the tension.
Except it was false.
Yeah. Sorry, we're going to go to the Cold War politics of the 1984 film directed by Peter Himes, the director of Capricorn One, The Star Chamber, The Presidio, Running Scared, and Time Cop, which is quite the resume.
Yeah, that's a swath of movies right there.
That it sure is. And he has a quote that I thought was pretty telling. His quote was, "I've never done anything that's totally worked for me. It's always been very painful to watch what I've done. Filmmaking, by definition, is a process of failure, and because of that, I always seem to be looking for the blemishes in my work." So that's a pretty rough way to live.
Yeah, I mean, way to have confidence, dude.
Life must have been a struggle, or maybe still is. I don't know if he's still alive.
I don't know.
So, Brother Jay, introduce us to this film.
Well, 2010, which was the second book in the trilogy of four books. This is loosely based on the book. It's hard to call it a sequel to 2001 because although the characters are shared, the story is kind of a endpoint to the beginning of 2001. The the lineality of this is a little suspect. So I said we're 2000. I was explaining this to boyfriend Jesse that
BFJ.
Where 2001 was a very deep thought, philosophical art movie about science fiction and future in space and origin of man. This was more of a popcorn flick, which had some science fiction elements and some good scary parts. I mean, it had some scary, scary parts to it. Some tension and some suspense. Not quite the same as 2001, but it has some elements that are fun and some elements that are scary. And so as a popcorn flick, it's great. If you're trying to compare it to 2001, you will just not be happy. There's no comparison. Although there's tons more dialogue in this movie than in 2001.
Well, yeah, let me tell you where I'm coming from. If you've listened to any of the episodes around our 2001 episode.
Well, and here's what I did. So first thing I did was boyfriend Jesse and I watched 2001.
Had he seen it before?
No, never.
Oh, okay. Well, we need to, can you sum up his reaction?
He liked it. I'd have to ask him more in depth. Let's see if I get a comment while I'm explaining something else. But, and then I listened to the podcast of 2001.
Our podcast?
Yes.
Okay. Which, to really get the full flavor, I still think you need to listen to the episode 2001 and then like the four episodes after it. When I started, because I kept picking that scab.
Well, and the thing about the 2001 podcast is you added in an addendum at the last half of the podcast from about a week later.
Okay, that's good. Does it make for interesting listening?
It's hard to listen to for me because we've changed the style of it, and it makes me kind of long for the style that we had. And I don't know if it's just. I'm not sure what difference is.
Well, hold on. Yeah, I'm interested in that. What do you mean?
Well, you should go back and listen to it. When we're discussing the movie in the podcast, there's some structure to it, but we just kind of have this free flowing conversation, and the plot is there, but we don't seem to be going at the plot as structured as we have been. And to me, it makes it feel like more organic.
Okay.
Of a process. As opposed to this really heavily scripted reading the plot. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I see that.
So, I don't...
You know what? If you're listening to this and you've heard of our pre-2016 episodes compared to our 2016 episodes, if you like the older style, just make a comment on this episode on the Not in a Creepy Way page. Make a comment. Hashtag oldies are goodies. And if you like the new ones, hashtag trio Anna, oh Anna. 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 Oh Anna. Berta. Berta. Roberta, Carla, Carla, oh Carla, Dieter, Dieter, oh Dieter, Peter, Peter, oh Peter, lass mich rein, lass mich raus, lass mich rein, lass mich raus, lass mich rein, lass mich raus. Nice. And I'm not saying one is better. I'm just, for me, I think they sound better, the older ones. But it's also, we have a different structure because there's the three of us. So there's a lot of changes. So, and I do not wish to go back to having just the two of us, not as, even though I do enjoy our special time together. as do I, not in a creepy way.
You know, I kind of like having the brothers Anderson together. So, I don't want to give that up, but I just think it seemed to have a better. It seemed less produced, I think.
That's true.
And so it seemed more natural. And so that's just one thing I noticed. However, I digress. So watch 2001, listen to the podcast. Watch 2010, and they're not comparable movies. They're just not. But I love 2010. It is a great movie. It's a great science fiction movie, and it's a great story, and it's got goddamn Helen Mirren in it, which I had completely... First of all, I didn't know it was her.
Oh, I know. She doesn't look like the Helen Mirren we know from recently, of course, because she's not a queen.
Well, also because the movie was made in 1984.
Yes. So she's post-Jennifer Lawrence Helen Mirren, but pre-Queen Elizabeth Helen Mirren. And also what it would prime suspect, right?
So when I saw it, when I watched it the other day, I lost my mind. Because as soon as the credits came in and, you know, her name came up, I thought for my synapses fired for just a moment. And I knew instantly, oh, that's who she is. And I knew I could picture her character in my head. So that was really kind of fun for me.
Well, I had forgotten all about John Lithgow being part of this movie.
Me too.
And of course, Bob Balaban. I'm used to Bob Balaban from comedies, and he is not playing this for comedies.
No, he's playing like genius savant, introvert.
Yeah.
He does a very, very good job, by the way.
I thought all the performances in this were good. Even John Lithgow, who was sort of over the top, like...
Well, and I predicted that if Drew has seen this movie, all the breathing into the microphones would probably drive him crazy.
Oh, we can't use it against him.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying it was more of a warning. Like, I feel bad because it got annoying to me, but not in a terrible way. But I can imagine if somebody is overly sensitive or just sensitive to things like that, it would drive, because it was on the verge of driving me a little around the bend. So,
well, there was the action, the tension was from a technological standpoint. But before we talk about that, let me just jump back a little bit. Maybe to be a little less, to go back to more structured by tangenting. I don't know how this works. here's a quick summation of my feelings about 2001. I thought it was beautiful, and I thought it was a pretentious art flick, art piece.
Do you think it was a Kubrick vanity project?
I don't know if it was a vanity project as much as he is an artist and he takes his art very seriously. So I think it was way more of an art movie than, say, Kubrick's The Shining, which I really like Kubrick's The Shining, as long as I don't, you know, compare it to the book, because I don't think that's actually fair. And while I was influenced by Stephen King suggesting that he hated the Kubrick film The Shining, you look back on it and you think, well, Stephen King was doing a lot of drugs and drinking back then, so...
So you're just discounting the opinion
a little bit, you know. It's I'm realizing that, hey, it turned out, and of course we didn't know that he was gonna delve into filmmaking and end up making what was that Emilio Estevez movie from the short story Trucks, Maximum Overdrive.
Oh God,
which is a bad movie about not a great story, but definitely a bad movie and a poorly directed movie, and just not great. But, okay, so I think 2001, still today, it's got really fascinating things. It's very beautiful. It's very artistic. But it's also, I think, a pretentious piece of crap because Kubrick didn't give you enough information. That's still my argument now, is that he didn't give you enough information to understand what the hell was going on. So while it was visually stunning to me, it was also left me feeling like, what? So 2010... is the opposite kind of movie. This is a movie that won't stop telling you what's going on. It tells you in just direct dialogue exposition. It tells you in voiceover narration. It tells you in the letters home, which take the place of narration and exposition. It is everything. The crew members talk all the time to each other about what's going on. So that, I can see where that would be a criticism, because... I know we've talked a lot about, we always appreciate movies that don't spoon-feed you the information. And this was actually IV-injected. It wasn't even spoon-fed. But I thought the story was understandable. And even though it went all trippy at the end, and it has a fundamental question that I guess we're still going to talk about. Now we just refer to it as AI. But I enjoyed it quite a bit. You know, even though the special effects were not 2001 level special effects, even in 1984, I had a good time.
So Boyfriend Jesse says, it was a good depiction, 2001, by the way. It was a good depiction of space exploration for its time. I liked the different aspects of it.
Okay, so then you guys watched 2010 together?
Yeah.
And what did you guys think about that? I mean, I know you dug it because it's a film from your childhood.
I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Yes.
Waiting response. Yeah, the effects were not as good. However, they had to recreate from scratch all of the set pieces.
And why?
Because Kubrick ordered all of them destroyed.
Exactly, because he didn't want anybody to reuse them.
Yeah, he didn't want them to be seen in any other movies.
Yes, which is kind of a jackass move.
Well, not necessarily. If you built this huge project and you put your blood, sweat, and tears into it, and you came up with 2001, which is still a great masterpiece.
Well, and they also he and Arthur C. Clarke wrote it at the same time, and that's why the book is different than the movie, because Kubrick wrote the script and Clarke wrote the novel, and of course they had tension because Kubrick made it so that the novel didn't come out until after the movie came out, so it actually cost Clarke money.
Well, so if you put all that effort into it, you don't want your brand soiled by some third-rate movie coming in and suddenly there's the USS Discovery floating in the background. So I can see that. I mean, you went to all the trouble to create it. It's your baby. You kind of want to defend it. So I can respect that to a point. I would rather have had he put it in an archive somewhere and saved it and locked it away so that, you know, there would have been available to 2010, but you know.
Well, I guess if he had it locked away, but he still didn't make it available, that would have been a bigger dick move.
Yes.
So, I guess I can understand that you wouldn't want to have them, you know, you wouldn't want to have a 1972 2010 or a 1974, you know, 2004 or something. So, I guess I can understand that. So, I'll forgive him for that. But Arthur C. Clarke was fully involved in this project.
He was.
It's funny because the 2001 took place all on Saturn and the moons of Saturn, but because of the success of the movie, he had to change the novel to the 2010 to have it all take place in Jupiter, Jupiter, which is kind of hilarious. I mean, it must have been one of the notable times that they kind of retconned another novel based on the success of the movie.
And also, this was a very preachy movie. This movie was not subtle, but it was preachy.
It was preachy. It had some strange elements, although, again, compared to 2001, it's not strange. It's pretty straightforward. So, first of all, we have the opening exposition, which is like basically watching a trailer for 2001. And I thought that was an interesting way of doing it. And so it kind of set the stage. If you hadn't seen 2001, or if you hadn't seen it lately, or hadn't read the book, then, you know, now you have a nice little stage to set on. Except they used a phrase from the book that wasn't in the movie. And then it seems iconic, so iconic that I thought it was in the original movie. But it's not. It's the quote that
Bowman's last words.
Yeah, my God, it's full of stars. So we have the fact that back on Earth, they know that the Discovery had an accident. They don't really know what. They've got this, I guess, Bowman's last words, and that's about all they know. And they have the position of it, because apparently they're able to, at least, maybe there's some rudimentary electronics on it aboard, or are they just strictly visually identifying it?
Well, it's satellite telemetry.
Okay. So, they've still got that going on. And then we meet Dr. Heywood Floyd, who's played by Roy Scheider in this case.
Which is, I think, not a bad choice.
No, it was fine. And we go to Jodie Foster's. Oh, it was the same place they shot Contact, right?
The very large array.
Yes. Although,
in New Mexico.
I guess in Contact, they went all over the place at different
radio
telescopes. But yeah. So you see the very iconic radio telescopes, which are very stunning. It would be interesting to actually visit, just to see in person what the scope and the scale of that is. So we have Roy Scheider, who is basically working for a university. And he has taken the blame for the problems of the Discovery mission.
Yeah, he took the public blame a bit.
And then we meet Dmitry Moiseevich, the Soviet counterpart to Floyd. Is that his job?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So he shows up, and there's very, very... Not, how about this? The Cold War thing is not very subtle here. It is still fully going on. Which, by the way, the Cold War, what did it? It pretty much ended like the next year or the year after.
Pretty much.
So the window on this movie, the Cold War tension, was kind of closing.
Yeah.
But that's okay. I thought they did a really good job. I mean, I thought, you know, although I thought that Dana Elkar's accent was not the greatest Russian accent.
Yeah. You know what I recognize Dana Elkar mostly from?
What?
MacGyver.
Was he MacGyver's boss? Like the head of the agency or something?
Pete Thornton was the character. I think that was his boss, yeah.
So he comes and they have a little a talk where you learn that the Soviets, I have to change my terms now. I had to educate myself out of using the Soviet Union. Now I got to go back talking about the Soviets, because the Soviets are sending up their mission, their spaceship, the Alexei Leonov. And the Americans are sending up another mission also, but the Leonov is going to be going a year earlier. So what Moiseevich is suggesting is that they want to... There's something happening, like the orbit is decaying of the Discovery. And so
have you checked the orbit?
So they're trying to... I just see the commercial with the lady with the sparkly teeth.
Fabulous.
Yeah. So they're going to concoct a way for some Americans to go aboard the mission with the Leonov, and they're going to make contact with the Discovery and find out what happened and possibly salvage it. And since that's an American ship, why not have Americans up there? And that'll justify why they're there. But the Cold War is in high gear, and neither the American president nor the Russian premier are interested at all, at least publicly, in cooperating.
So, boyfriend Jesse reports, 2010 was not as deep as 2001, but it held up on its own. The movies are fairly incomparable. The interaction between the Russians and the Americans were interesting, being that we were in competition to reach the moon with them. Explained a lot of the loose ends that the 2001 left.
Excellent. So here's all yada yada some of the plot. But we have, we meet Victor Milson, who's the director of the NSA, and he's going to have to go before the president and try to sell this this joint mission. And so that's kind of fun. And then we meet Floyd's wife, who's an oceanographer, I think, and their son and two dolphins as pets.
Yeah, I wrote, he ambushes his wife with the fact that he's leaving, but it's nice that they have dolphins in their living room.
Yeah, and as it turns out, that's not as weird as I thought it was. I mean, because I don't know about you, but in 2016, it seems like having dolphins as pets is not probably the most politically correct.
Well, except that the implication wasn't that they were pets as much as that she was either resuscitating them or they were research, because she was giving a lecture on them. Because she was also telling her son about, you know, how they're not fish and they're smart and all this.
Well, that's true. But did you realize that in real life, Roy Scheider had dolphins as pets? And you no, might also know him from Sequest 2032.
I do remember him from Sequest. I watched that show. It was a terrible show. They had a talking dolphin.
Well, of course.
The talking dolphin's name was Darwin, by the way.
Oh, I do remember that. I think it was I don't think I watched the show faithfully or anything, because I was thinking it was just a tiny bit too old for it, because it was in 1993. But anyway. Okay, so Floyd gets to go on the mission, and also... two other Americans. One is Walter Kernow, who's played by John Lithgow, who is the designer of the Discovery. So theoretically, he's going to be the one to come and turn it on, make sure everything works right, fix whatever's broken. And then we have the creator of HAL, whose name is Dr. Chandra, played by Bob Balaban. And Dr. Chandra is kind of, he's a computer nut. And I did not know this, but do you know who voiced HAL's like successor model?
I did know this because I recognized your voice the first time I saw the movie. Candace Bergen.
Yeah, Candace Murphy Brown.
That's exactly why I knew the voice.
Yeah.
I love Murphy Brown.
Oh, yeah. Very political. Dan Quayle was against Murphy Brown. Remember the days where Dan Quayle misspelled potato and we all thought it was meant he wasn't eligible to serve as the vice president? Anyway.
Yeah.
So.
I remember Bob Balaban from the first season of The West Wing, where he has a confrontation with President Bartlett.
Well, is Bob Balaban in the Christopher Guest movies, or am I thinking of another actor?
Oh, I don't know. It's possible. What?
Because I know there are a couple actors who look a little bit Balaban-esque. We're going to go back to the hallmark of Eric, who will misidentify actors. That was a hallmark of season one, most definitely, of Not in a Creepy Way.
Oh, he was in Recount, Entourage.
He was in Best in Show. Yep, he's the guy I'm thinking of.
He was in Gosford Park.
Hey, there's a movie that I own but haven't watched because apparently you need to watch it with subtitles on.
Well, not necessarily. If you are very adept at the British accent, you'll be fine. The problem is if you are perhaps slightly impaired of hearing and are not attenuated to the British accent, you will have some difficulties.
Well, hopefully I don't have either of those difficulties at the moment, but we'll see.
But Gosford Park's a great movie.
Is it a thriller?
Thriller is too strong. It's kind of almost an Agatha Christie-style movie. Does that make sense?
Well, is it like a suspense?
There's some mystery? Suspense to it. Yeah, there's definitely a mystery element
but
to it.
But it's not really a thriller.
It involves a murder. Yeah, it's not a thriller per se, but it's a mystery movie.
Okay. Well, maybe we should put it on the calendar to force us to give it a shot.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely watch it again and again. It's good. It's got a great cast.
So So then we have meet the crew of the Leonov, and there's only really three crew members I care about in the Leonov. One is the captain, who is Captain Tanya Kubrick, or I'm sorry, Kerbuck, played by Helen Mirren, with a bad 80s perm and a Russian accent, but still, she does yeoman's work. Then there is the cosmonaut Irina Yakunia, played by Natasha Schneider, who, she was a like punk rock singer.
Yeah.
Who went by the name Natasha Detente during this time.
Oh, dear. I in my mind, she plays for Pussy Riot.
Exactly. She's, yes. So, we're not going to talk about
see what I did there?
Yeah, I see what you did there. Yeah, so. And then we have a cosmonaut, Max Bailovsky, played by Elia Baskin, who I cannot separate him. I know it's maybe a story.
Oh, no. From Yakov Smirnoff?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, God.
Like, I kept saying for him to look dead at the camera and say, about the country.
Oh, man.
By the way, I have nothing but respect for Yakov Smirnoff.
No, he's...
He came to America. He made it big. He lived the American dream. And now he's a very patriotic American citizen.
Oh?
Who has his own theater in Branson, where he does comedy shows still. But also is a serious painter, and a lot of his themes are patriotic American themes.
Patriotic, like...
Like, he did a really big, 9/11 memorial mural thing that's very impressive. And not over the top. I mean, he's like a legitimate artist, so...
By the way, if you look up Ilya Baskin's IMDb page, he has done a crap load of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did stuff in Russian... and then he came to America and he played the typical Russian stereotype, I think, in a lot of movies.
Oh, yeah. Tons of stuff.
But, you know...
13 Days, that's a great movie. I gotta put that on the list.
Absolutely. Yeah, so you know how Let's see. I'm trying to think of somebody who else that you just like. You just enjoy them. Like, he is one of them. He just has, he's got a charm. He's got an infectious smile. He's a good actor. Kind of like John Lithgow. Like, I was happy to see John Lithgow, but I think actually John Lithgow's performance was not quite as good as Elia Baskin's.
I would agree with that. But I also think the role, he was meant to be a bumbling idiot.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is, you know, the cosmonauts were actually supposed to be highly trained cosmonauts. And the three Americans are all scientists or engineers. Yeah. Well, none of them have actually trained as astronauts, except for what little time they did before going on the mission. They were not space specific mission specialists. They were basically job oriented specialists.
Yeah, they were desk jockeys that are shot into space.
So we had, I thought actually, even though it wasn't quite the 2001 level of special effects, I thought the special effects were pretty good.
I did too.
You know, the computers for the time are computers of the time, and they didn't try to mess with that too much. And I thought that, you know, they did some, like all of the space work was really well done. That was mostly green screen.
Yeah, and they had some good shots of the spaceships, and they did some obvious. There's some obvious sleight of hand, and you know the air braking scene with the balut was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. So, and, you know, part of the criticism was that a lot of the beginning of this movie, you know, Roy Scheider just gets ready for the trip, but doesn't have a lot to do, and then on the spaceship he doesn't have a lot to do either, at least in the very beginning.
No, he's master exposition, though.
No, he is, absolutely. Yeah, but he's there for knowledge. He's not there for, again, action scenes.
Yeah,
he's,
I mean, he's
a swashbuckler.
He's there to make sure that they can get data out of the ship. And that the Russians don't get knowledge that the Americans don't have.
Yeah, or at least, I mean, because one of the things they really stressed hard, again, they were not subtle in this movie, is that when it all comes down to it, people are people. Governments can fight, but people are people, and all these people are just space explorers and scientists on this ship, so they should work together, no matter what their governments are doing. And then we have, again, we have this, of course, the balut air braking thing, which is very dramatic, and then they have the extra vehicular activity where John Lithgow gets freaked out, and Elia Baskin tests the air quality by just opening his helmet and taking a deep breath.
Yeah.
Yes. And I thought that moment when he suddenly is super scared, I thought that was actually pretty well done.
No, there's a couple of pretty scary, that was a pretty scary part.
And it's all going on in his head. You don't see anything. You just realize that he is getting this realization that, wait, I'm smelling something that's kind of a rotten smell. Like something is rotting. Like what could be rotting? It's full of space food, tang, and
bugs. Dead astronaut.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then there's also, you know, once they, you know, when they start reactivating Hal, when Dr. Chandra starts reactivating Hal, and Hal starts, you know, his speech synthesizers just start freaking out. That is pretty creepy, at least to me.
Is Hal a good villain? I mean, is Hal an effective, scary villain, even though he's not really a villain in this movie? And he's not really a villain in the first one, but because you don't know what happened, he's the bad guy.
Well, he's a villain. He killed people.
He did indeed.
So that makes him a villain, as far as I'm concerned. Now, just because he did it because he was confused or scared, or for whatever reason Dr. Chandra makes... because Dr. Chandra justifies the murders.
Dr. Chandra is very, he is very interested in Hal's feelings. He treats Hal like a person.
He treated Sal like a person because when Sal asked him, you know, when he explained to Sal that he wanted to take her apart, basically, and put her back together and see what happened because they were going to do the same thing to Hal... she asked him, you know, will I dream? And he says, of course, all intelligent creatures dream. But when you get to the end of 2010, and Hal is asking, a similar question, you know, he honestly says, I don't know. So he really believes at that point that Hal is a living entity, if you will, living intelligence. But he's absolutely a villain, especially when you take into account the fact that Hal has the ability to control the entire ship and basically evacuate the ship and kill everyone at any moment through any number of, I'm sure, interesting ways. Opening an airlock here, you know, depressurizing this or reducing heat that, or he has many options of death at his CPU. So I think that makes a pretty terrifying villain. More so when in 2001, when it just becomes, you know, at first it's Frank, you know, Dave Bowman and Frank Poole. And that's kind of scary. And then Hal basically kills Frank Poole. And it's just Dave Bowman versus Hal. And that's really terrifying.
Yeah, that's what I liked about the 2001 to me. It was weird because of the monkey thing, but it had my interest because you didn't know where it was going, so it was weird. And then I thought at first, the first time I saw it, I thought that it was definitely boring in the middle part. But when I watched it for the podcast, I realized, okay, there's something going on here. I just don't understand what it is. And they're spending a lot of time showing off a la Star Trek The Motion Picture, where they're showing off just the grandeur of the special effects, which, as it turns out, is not what makes long-lasting good cinema, I don't think.
Well, either they were showing it off at the time because they were like, look at us, look what we can do, when exactly. Really it just detracted from the plot.
Well, the problem is at the time, I'm sure it was really great. It was like stupendous and a reason to go to the movies.
But it doesn't stand up.
Exactly. And when if you don't have a good plot underneath it, you know, that's a problem.
It's just killing time.
The name of the movie. But this movie, have you seen Ex Machina, the movie?
No. No.
We should put that on the list because it's very interesting. And when we talk about whether or not Hal should be treated like a person, we could talk about Ex Machina also.
Okay.
So it should go on the list probably sooner than later. Although our list is very long. I think I'm already to the second half of 2017 on the calendar already.
So I can stop taking the blame now.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to squeeze your movies in there. We can't. Yeah, it's funny. It seems like you were taking the blame, but there have been a lot of Drew movies in a row. Or if not Drew movies, they're just movies that Drew liked and you didn't. So I think we should break those up. It's not quite fair for you to be the hater of all the movies we pick.
Oh, no, I'm fine hating all the movies.
Yeah, well,
still. I'm good with that.
It just seems like a punishment to you.
But I mean, I don't feel punished. This is a labor of love.
Well, we will not run out of good movies for a very long time. We're just going to get the occasional Tiptoes, or what was another one that we roundly disliked?
Primer.
Well, it's funny because, like I said, Primer, if we were to do it all over again, the three of us would.
Source Code. Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
Because it's not even that it has to be a bad movie. It just has to be a meh movie.
Exactly.
The meh movies are the worst because there's not enough to go on about how bad they are, and there's not enough to go on about how good they are. So you're stuck with just the mediocrity.
And that's why comedies are hard to do too, because, you know, comedy is such a specific thing. Like an experiential thing, that talking about comedy doesn't give you the same enjoyment as listening to the comedy or seeing the comedy to begin with.
Yeah, we might have to start doing double feature comedies.
Yeah, maybe. Like to compare and contrast right within one show.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. I hadn't thought about that.
Because that way there's enough substance to draw it out. Especially because they tend to be shorter movies to watch anyway,
yeah.
So you could squeeze them in theory, but not that I wish to torture my brothers with having to watch more movies, but
No, it's, I'm fine. As long as I have enough notice, I'm good to go.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's where we have more plot stuff. So we reach the Discovery. We turn the Discovery on. We, of course, Hal was deactivated by Dave in the last movie. So now we have to reactivate Hal, and Chandra's kind of concerned that it's going to be a problem. And Roy Scheider, he has to balance, like Haywood Floyd has to balance the turning Hal back on with the fact that Hal could just wipe everybody out. So he has John Lithgow, like, hide a mechanical kill switch, yeah.
Yeah, because Haywood Floyd's concern is we don't know what made him go bonkers to begin with, and not knowing what made him go bonkers means we can't necessarily avoid it from happening again. And that's a problem, because he pretty much controls everything.
Yeah, and Chandra is very, very protective of Hal, like I said, and wants to tell Hal only the truth, because as we find out, the reason why Hal went crazy is that he was programmed to lie to the crew, and he is not good at lying, and so he had the internal conflict.
Yeah, he was issued contradictory, conflicting instructions, and he was told basically to give all of the mission data to the crew without any obfuscation, and then he was given the other mission in addition and told not to tell the crew until a certain time. And those were in conflict with his protocol, never to obscure information, conceal information to the crew. And so he became, quote unquote, paranoid, didn't know what to do. And so he basically did the only remedy he knew how to get out of his logic loop, which was kill everybody.
If lying to the crew made him feel nervous, he could take away the nerves by killing everybody. So no crew, no lying. Perfect.
Although the mission fails at that point. So I'm not sure a computer that can play chess like that would have made those choices. But, you know, that makes for the plot.
No, but part of the lie was what the mission was to begin with. Because Hal has to keep telling people, hey, I keep pretending like the mission that the crew knows is the real mission, but turns out it's a whole different thing.
Right.
So this is actually very well explained to us by Chandra. This is the only part of the movie where I thought that Roy Scheider went way over the top. When Chandra points out that, oh no, it was you, it was Floyd's people, it was, as it turns out, the NSA... who had this backdoor mission programmed in. And, of course, Floyd's response is...
Since Hal was capable of operating Discovery without human assistance, it was decided that he should be programmed to complete the mission autonomously in the event the crew was incapacitated or killed. He was given full knowledge of the true objective and instructed not to reveal anything to Bowman or Poole. He was instructed to lie.
What are you talking about? I didn't authorize anyone to tell Hal about the monolith.
The directive is NSC 342/23, top secret, January 30, 2001.
NSC, National Security Council, the White House.
I don't care who it is. The situation was in conflict with the basic purpose of Hal's design, the accurate processing of information without distortion or concealment. He became trapped. The technical term is an H. Mobius loop, which can happen in advanced computers with autonomous goal-seeking programs.
The goddamn White House. I don't believe it.
I was told to lie by people who find it easy to lie. Hal doesn't know how. So he couldn't function. He became paranoid.
Those sons of bitches. I didn't know. I didn't know.
Which I thought was a little over the top.
Well, but some of that is he had been beating himself up over the deaths anyway. And now it was a frustration that he had been beating himself up and he didn't know the full story. And so his blame was unfounded, but it wouldn't have changed anything.
And in the meantime, or slightly before this piece of sound, but weird stuff starts to happen. For instance, we have Dave Bowman showing up all over the place, and we find that he actually visits his widow, and the widow Bowman is played by Mary Jo Deschanel, mother of Zoe.
Yeah.
And he also visits his terminally ill mother, who's played by Herta Ware. And he combs her hair. He is a ghost. They actually have the hairbrush on wires brushing your hair, which I think was not necessary, but oh well. So consider it dolphins.
Well, again, it was a nice visual.
Yeah. But then we have the moment where we have a Bowman talking directly to Floyd. Floyd is like, nah, you know, he's doing the whole Cosby Noah thing.
You see, Noah was a carpenter, and he was in his rec room sawing away, making a few things for the home there.
Vuba, 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 Noah. Vuba, 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 Noah.
Who is that?
It's the Lord, Noah.
Right. Where are you? What do you want? I've been good.
I want you to build an ark.
Right. What's an ark?
Go out into the woods, collect all of the animals in the world by twos, and make the ark out of cubits, 80 cubits, 40 cubits, 30 cubits.
Right. What's a cubit?
Sure, you're Dave Bowman. Right. By the way, he's not doing the Cosby thing like drugging Tanya Kubrick. Although he did get a little cuddle time during the Bloop maneuver. Although I thought that scene was actually handled really well, because in a lesser movie they would have actually had sex or something, but really she was just looking for comfort because she thought she might die, and it was a scary situation, and he was scared too, so it worked out.
Well, yeah, because it was a procedure that they had never undertaken before, so the outcome was not exactly certain.
No, and it was the consequences were rather grim if it wasn't going to work.
Your tolerances and your margins of error are pretty slight.
Yeah.
Because if you skip off the atmosphere at those speeds, you go off uncontrollably and you can't correct, and you're basically just vectoring off into Nowhereville.
Yeah. Or you get it drawn the other way and you are going straight into Jupiter and dying.
Yeah, that would be a bummer.
It would.
Because you'd probably just burn up.
So in the meantime, now back home, we have tensions between the U.S. and the Soviet Union escalating, and they have this sort of a Cuban Missile Crisis sort of thing going on, and they are technically in a state of war after a Russian ship is sunk, an American plane, oh, I'm sorry, an American satellite is destroyed. So all of a sudden, both governments are saying, hey, and they're kicking all their crews to their respective ships, which is actually particularly scary for the Americans because, you know, they're on this ship that actually had been broken.
They're on like the demon ship.
Well, and it's explained that they both have only enough fuel to do this like low speed or shorter distance return trip.
Yeah.
They can't just turn around and go back home. They have to wait for the right time, otherwise.
Short trajectory, low consumption return.
Yes. So they have like a month to wait or something. But then Bowman shows up and says, oh no, you don't have a month. You have 2 days. What do you mean I have 2 days? 2 days.
Yeah. Make it work.
It's like, what's happening in 2 days? Something wonderful.
Right.
Which, to me, sounds a lot like Marshall Applewhite of the Hail Bop, what do they call it? Heaven's Gate people. Why do we have to castrate ourselves, get in the same matching Nike jumpsuits, and put a roll of quarters in our pockets, Marshall? Because something wonderful is happening.
Right.
And, of course, Floyd doesn't know whether he's losing his mind, too. And that's where this movie goes back to the cosmic weirdo roots of 2001, where we don't know what's going on with Floyd. And we're also seeing, we're seeing Bowman from 2001. We're seeing Old Man Bowman.
Old Man Bowman.
We're seeing also Space Baby Bowman.
Well, or Space Baby. You're not sure it's Space Baby Bowman.
There's a lot of things we're unsure about in this movie. Again, we still don't know what's going on with the monolith, although at the end, well, we're getting a better idea. Or not, maybe. But we're also, like, when they sent the probe down to Europa, because they discovered chlorophyll, I neglected to say that they woke up Floyd earlier than they were supposed to, because there was something going on. But they weren't really interested in telling him all the details of what was going on. So there's a little bit of consternation in Floyd's attitude.
Well, because there was something that was going on. The government, U.S. government, insisted that Floyd be awoken. Just in case.
So they discover chlorophyll on Europa. So,
which would be somewhat significant.
Yeah. I was going to try to throw a Zoo Europa. Chlorophyll comes from the fact that she wore lemon. But we have a probe that goes down to Europa. And I thought that was kind of fun. But the probe then ends up getting shot out into space in some look like on purpose direction. And then later, when we send Max out to the monolith, which seems pretty unwise.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah. He gets shot off into space. And now, does he die? Or is he sent off to Bowman Land?
I think the implication that he is dead.
Okay.
Because he's sent away at speeds that are probably not survivable. And it's unclear what exactly happens to him. But with Bowman, you know, Bowman's basically wormholed into the monolith.
Which we don't really, still we don't know what the monolith is. Like, the monolith on the moon seemed to be some sort of alarm signal. And the monolith around Jupiter, we didn't even know what it was, except that it's full of stars. Maybe some sort of portal. But once Max gets shot out, and then the tensions between the governments come along. And did you notice the cover of Time magazine? Where it shows, like, America at war or whatever, and it has, like, cartoons of both world leaders. The American president looks like Arthur C. Clarke, and the Russian premier looks like Stanley Kubrick.
No, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, go back and check that part out. It's pretty hilarious.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so Bowman visits Floyd. So Floyd has to go knocking on the door of the Leonov and talking to Tanya. So he's like, arrest me if you have to, but I'm coming over. And then he comes over and tells Tanya that, no, they have to leave in 2 days. And Tanya's like, look, I don't know what you're smoking, or you're drinking your Kentucky
whiskey.
Yes. So, but we can't do that. We don't have enough fuel to do that. We're not going to do that. Thank you.
Yeah, the physics do not allow for it.
Yes. And then so Floyd comes up with, oh, well, here's how we're going to do it. And I don't know if you saw the outtakes, but
I did.
Shooting the scene where he's trying to get that pen
the
to
pen.
Float. Yeah, was kind of hilarious. So I will put a link to the outtakes where he's trying to get that stupid pen to work.
It's awesome. And then when he finally gets it to stick, and he loses his shit and ruins the shot.
Exactly, yes. So it's very funny. So anyway, they've got this way for them both to get back on time. And as they're kind of squabbling about it, the monolith just disappears.
Oops.
Yes, so they're like, oh, well, maybe we should take this seriously, because maybe something really is happening. And then, by the way, they get sent a transmission about the troubles on Earth. But also says, hey, we've noticed this weird black spot on Jupiter. Can you check it out the next time it comes around?
Because they wouldn't have noticed this giant growing black spot on the planet behind them.
Yes. Well, turns out this black spot is pretty worrisome. We learn that the spot is full of monoliths. And they keeps growing. The amount of monoliths keeps multiplying.
Which is, by the way, the first time I saw this movie, it was scary as shit.
Yeah, I thought the effect was pretty good. Much better before they went down and you saw individual monoliths.
The super zoom.
Yeah, I think it was much better from the matte painting or computer painting artwork they had outside. There's a lot of practical effects because this is 1984, after all.
Yeah.
But we have Chandra, who is really worried about, once we figure out that, okay, we're going to use the Discovery as basically just a booster rocket, and everybody's going to end up on the Leonov, and
Hal will be left alone again.
Yes, stranded. And possibly destroyed. So Chandra has a problem with that, and also has a problem with the fact that if Hal detects that he's being lied to, Hal could just not do what he's supposed to do, and they need Hal's supercomputer to be able to precisely fire off their rockets and use their fuel efficiently. Because they screw that up, they're dead. So then we have this whole conflict between... Well, it's mostly a conflict between Chandra and Floyd, not Chandra and Hal, because Chandra is still Hal's protector. But did you think maybe that Chandra was going to stay aboard the Discovery, or maybe kind of have to be prevented from destroying the whole mission because if he was going to save Hal at their own expense?
Yeah, he was a big variable, so I thought that all options were possible at that point.
Yeah.
He was going to stay behind as martyr, he was going to stay behind as protector and comfort, or he was going to stay behind because Hal was going to blackmail him to stay behind.
Yes, any or all that could happen.
Yeah, if you stay with me, I will let the others go. But I don't want to die alone.
Yeah. And you get the sense that the Chandra character would have most definitely gone for that.
Well, they joke earlier in the movie where they think he is, they make the point of saying, I think he is Hal.
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Then we have the special effects where they set off toward home. And then the monoliths are growing like crazy on Jupiter, and all of a sudden, bad, bad, bad things happen. And I've got a question for you about this, too. But as they're trying to blast out and get back on their thing, suddenly it becomes a very important mission for them to go as quickly as they can out of there, because Jupiter is imploding. And it sends out this massive shockwave.
It's having basically a big bang.
Yeah, it's turning into a star.
Yeah.
Which is something incredible. I thought it was very incredible to watch and very fascinating science. But don't you think another sun would kind of mess up Earth's... It would mess up so much. It would mess up orbits because the gravity changes.
Circadian rhythms.
It would screw up that. It would increase global warming.
Crops.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so, a great many things. Also, plus the sudden creation of a giant sun, the shockwave would devastate anything in its path.
Oh, I think it would knock everything off of its orbit, off of its axis. It would also, it would change so much about the solar system geometry.
But, maybe it would knock Earth's moon out of existence, and then the axial tilt would straighten up, and then the ozone hole would go away, and who knows?
I mean, and really, at this point, we're still dealing with kind of metaphor.
But you're right. That was the one problem that I've always had with the movie, is that the creation of a sun in the center of our universe, our current universe, just seems ridiculous. It would destroy everything.
I think so. And, the poetry of it is undeniable, I think. The fact that Now the children of the one sun are going to, now from now on, they'll be only children of the two suns. So I thought that was pretty great. And then this mysterious message.
Pretty preachy.
Yes, is beamed to Earth. And the message is, all these worlds are yours except for Europa. Attempt no landing. Use them together. Use them in peace. Which, by the way, I think that differs from the book. I think they added that last line in there for the movie. So you'd get the crowd to go, aww.
Capture that Cold War tension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have basically scenes after that with the sun, the two suns, the twin suns, appearing in the sky over various places and on Earth. And then you have... Now, are we meant to believe that that last scene is the monolith sitting in the swamp on Europa?
Yes.
Okay. So, have...
Because the next book takes place... Although I didn't think it was Europa, but I haven't read the book in so long. But I remember the opening of the book where it is on a some kind of planetary body, so...
Well, and... Have we ever just settled on what the monolith is?
Well, and I think the monolith is just the MacGuffin. I think the monolith is just, it's not, although it is visualized in the movie as this black 1x2x3 box, impenetrable by anything.
Yeah, they tried to nuke it. Still couldn't penetrate.
Yeah, of course, because as Americans, how typical is that, though? It exactly sounds like something we would do.
Oh, totally.
Let's see. We don't know what this thing is, so we're going to use atomics to blow it apart.
Yeah, we're going to... I mean, what we cause if we try to nuke it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
I think the point of the monolith was that the black... symbol itself is meaningless. It is whatever you want it to be, in as much as it's just a force of outside influence and intelligence of another race, alien, culture, future, whatever you want to believe it is, that has the intellect that is greater than the sum of our intellect that helps us grow and move forward. So, I think rather than having a green-skinned, tall, scaly alien that has some kind of intellect, this is a much more palatable, easy way for the audience to kind of take in that and move forward rather than being distracted by, ooh, look at the alien.
Yeah, plus you don't... You know, making something that's basically like a stone tablet almost makes it so that you don't, you know, you run the risk of, if you make a monster, you run the risk of seeing the zipper.
Well, also you have to have I guess you don't have to, but the likelihood is that you're going to be asked at some point to explain the history and the origin and the path and the process and all of the trappings that may ensue. Where when you just have this simple 1x2x3 black box, there's not much explanation needed.
Well, exactly, yeah, and you're right. It's a MacGuffin. It doesn't really matter, as long as the characters think that it matters.
But in a way, it's kind of brilliant that way because it doesn't distract the audience enough that they are stuck in what's the alien going to do? What's this force going to do? What's the motivation? What's the, all of those things where I think
you don't have to worry about the consequence of two suns all of a sudden.
Exactly. So you don't think too much about the alien itself. And I'm calling it an alien, but I'm just using it as an example. You're not too distracted in that to get pulled out of the movie, where I think sometimes if it would have been a spaceship or a flying saucer or a little green man, I think that may have detracted some from the movie. So it simplifies the storytelling, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I get it. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, so overall, we end with a nice hopeful message.
Preachy, and, preachy, preachy.
Yeah, definitely preachy. But, you know, I think that's what it was intended to do. So I think on that sense, it succeeds as a movie.
Although, it's why attempt no landing? What are you trying to hide?
Well, that's for the next movie. That's for 2060 whatever, right?
I think it was 2033, but maybe. I could be wrong.
And then 3001 was the fourth of the trilogy.
Because all good trilogies have to have four books.
Sure. Absolutely. So your verdict?
I think this is a great movie. Again, I don't think you can compare the two, because I don't think they're comparable.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think they're comparable. I don't think they're the same genre of movie. Like, this is you're right. This is a popcorn science fiction movie where 2001 was a pretentious piece of crap art film. More or less. Actually, that's not fair. It's a pretentious art film. It's not a piece of crap. It's actually quite stunning.
Again, I understand you didn't care for it, which is fine. We're all entitled to our opinion, as wrong as they may be. But you know, I agree with you. I think that this, you know, but again, this was a fun movie. So, as it should be.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a summertime. This is a summer blockbuster. It's not a Oscar contender movie.
Yes. I would agree with that.
So. Okay, so, 2010, the year we made contact, starring the HAL 9000, who also starred as himself in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Banana! Okay, that's, I'm probably not going to keep that in there.
So, the novels are 2001, A Space Odyssey, 2010, Odyssey 2, 2061, Odyssey 3, 3001, The Final Odyssey. So, 2010, Odyssey 2, the 1982 novel adapted as a 1984 film. 2061, Odyssey 3, 87 novel adaptation planned for late 2019.
Well, that'll be interesting.
So, and 3001, The Final Odyssey, adaptation planned for 2020. So we have hope for to revisit this twice more in the podcast.
Maybe they can make them at the same time. And Tom Hanks can play all the characters.
Oh, dear. So Dr. Chandra, in the book, I don't even know if I can say this name. Dr. Sivas Subramanian Chandra Sigrigam Pillal, abbreviated as Dr. Chandra.
So is he from Sri Lanka? Like, because I think Arthur C. Clarke ended up in Sri Lanka for a long time, right?
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. So I enjoyed 2010.
I figured you would. I enjoy it too. And again, it's different. It's not, you can't, you have to divorce yourself. It's in the same universe, but it's not in the same class.
Yeah, it's comparing apples to Fabergé eggs.
I would say it's comparing Easter eggs to cream eggs.
There you go.
One is something that you paint and can be pretty and put on a shelf, and the other is sickly sweet, and you'll eat it and you'll feel hungry an hour later.
You know that for Halloween they have scream eggs that are green inside?
I do. But I actually like, they make... And it's not the mini eggs, it's the mini cream eggs. Because the mini eggs are just chocolate with that crap candy coating that I hate. They make mini cream eggs. They're about a third of the size.
Huh.
And I love those because they're just the right size where I can have a couple and they don't make me ill. Because a whole cream egg is...
Oh, yeah.
I love them, but no, it's too much all at once.
Yeah, it's not for pleasure. Oh, it's for pleasure. It's not for...
It's gluttony.
Yeah, yeah, so.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.